Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this Honorable Court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this Honorable Court.
Thank you very much. And this is the point in time where I would say you may be seated, but hopefully you are seated. And good morning to everybody. We appreciate you are participating on this WebEx version of oral arguments with the Nebraska Supreme Court. Our first case of the day is State versus Juan G. Martinez. Justice Frydenberg is recused in this matter. And in our second case of the day, Justice Miller Lerman is recused. Just a little bit of background for everybody there. Those of you lawyers who are not participating on this case, you may simply be spectators at this point in time, and likewise, lawyers on this case, after you have argued, you may either stay online and be spectators, or you may leave the WebEx conference call. With that in mind, does anybody have any questions before we begin?
Chief, this is Justice Miller Lerman. I'll leave the meeting after the first case is argued.
Thank you very much. Anybody else with questions or comments before we begin? With that, then, I believe, is it Ms. Newell? You're arguing this morning?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court? My name is Ella Newell. I'm a senior certified law school student here with Jennifer Holden on behalf of appellant. I ask to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. As discussed in our brief, there were multiple legal errors in appellant's jury trial. The most important of these issues is establishing a clear standard for courts and counsel to determine reliability of translated statements in keeping with the rules of evidence and the due process rights of criminal defendants. We ask this court to establish a clear standard for admission of translated statements under the party opponent exception that ensures the translated statements are reliable, fairly attributable to the defendant's intended meaning, and using acknowledged professional standards in the field of language interpretation to do so.
Counsel, in this particular case, the only objections that were made at trial were hearsay and foundation. Isn't that correct?
While there were hearsay objections made at trial, we believe that there isn't a clear standard in Nebraska case law to determine whether or not a translated statement was in fact made by the defendant under the party opponent exception.
You're getting ahead of me here. I want to be clear about what's on the table. And there was no, at trial, no confrontation clause objection, correct?
Correct.
So all we're and the brief does not argue foundation.
I believe that the police interpreter witness I believe that her credentials were questioned on foundation and her ability to answer those questions as part of a foundational objection. But the foundation, hearsay, and language conduit theory are the major points of objection today.
So foundation, of course, is a general objection. And what is it about the way that it was brought up at trial that makes you assert that it was brought home to the trial judge what the nature of the foundational objection was?
Ultimately, the police interpreter witness was not qualified to make these translations because she couldn't explain how or why she came to those conclusions. Her explanations were devoid of content and were without a basis in linguistic or interpretive substance.
So was that problem, the way you see it, connected with the foundational objection and brought to the attention of the trial judge in that way? In other words, qualifications equals foundation.
Yes, Your Honor.
And
was your objection, oh, I beg your pardon.
Go ahead.
Was the objection essentially one based on competence, not competent to testify as the translator was being presented?
Yes, Your Honor. There were several instances during trial. So the police interpreter witness added commas, periods, question marks, and ellipses to appellant's text messages. And when asked why she decided to use periods, how she decided what were misspellings in Spanish that were unmarked in the English translation, she couldn't give any substantive answer. The majority of her answers were that she just feels like that's where a different sentence starts, that she wasn't really making a decision. And so part of it is her explanations for why she did what she did.
Well, again, you're talking about substance, and I want to be sure that we have in front of us, I don't think there's anything about a competence objection that was made on the record, was there?
That is part of the foundational requirements of this, that we believe that qualified people can explain why they do what they do, and because she was unable to explain why she did what she did, that.
All right, go ahead then with your, you can proceed to the substance. And I agree that I think this is the heart of your appeal, this language issue, but it is in front of us essentially on hearsay, right?
Foundation and hearsay, yes.
Well, assume for the moment that we disagree with you that the foundational objection is made, preserved, or argued on appeal, and assume for purposes of argument that the only thing in front of us is hearsay. What does that do?
You can do that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. The rules of evidence presume, so this is not a common issue, but when the issue arises, it is of the utmost importance to ensure that statements admitted into evidence are actually a communication that are fairly attributable to the criminal defendant. The party opponent rule was designed to give the fact finder an opportunity to analyze what the defendant said. And the rules of evidence presume that because the defendant made the statement, that the evidence admitted was in fact a communication of the defendant, and therefore the evidence is reliable and relevant. However, in a circumstance involving language interpretation, the court must take the additional step to confirm that the statement is in fact the defendant's. Appellant's due process rights were violated when the police interpreter witnesses' translations were given to a jury under the guise of appellant statements.
Well, due process wasn't raised at trial, was it?
No, it was not, Your Honor.
So that one's not on the table, right?
Your Honor, it goes to the prejudicial standard of what the statements contained in themselves. It's a clear rule of interpretation that translators cannot add or omit anything to what is stated or written. And under these facts, the police interpreter witness added a fair amount of punctuation that did prejudice appellant. I do believe that that was raised at trial. I believe that counsel made the objection that there was a due process violation.
Counsel, is it your contention that the punctuation changed the meaning?
Yes, it is our contention. That is what we are arguing, Your Honor.
Just an example.
In one of the different text messages that were used, the police interpreter witness added ellipses that made the statements seem much more incriminating than they were, simply because they were not included. And at one point, I believe it's on page 3 of Exhibit 12, that there are ellipses after the word unforgivable, and there are ellipses that are contained quite a few times in the English translation that make the statement seem more incriminating, and those ellipses are not present in the Spanish text messages themselves.
Before your time runs completely out, why would this not be harmless error if we assume that it was error, why is it not harmless?
Because it is un because the statements were admitted under the party opponent rule as provided by the language conduit theory, and they are not the defendant's statements. And these statements contained quite a bit of information within the translation of words like forgivable, of words that would denote some sort of guilt. And the admission of these text messages under these circumstances would be a violation of due process and did prejudice appellant.
In our interpreter jurisprudence, we have never said that an interpretation must be perfect, have we?
We know that the interpreter, part of what this is trying to achieve is that interpreters can have different levels of discretion within their interpretation, but if it's going to be admitted under the party opponent rule, it needs to be fairly attributable to appellant. And then under these circumstances, it was not. I ask to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Morning. May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee of the state of Nebraska. Martinez assigns 5 errors on appeal. I will also focus primarily on the hearsay claim pertaining to the admission of Martinez's statements. And I guess before getting into that, I would address Justice Castle's questions with respect to what issues are before the court. And while there were some discussions below with respect to foundation and related matters, my reading of the appellant's brief, their assignments of error, as well as the argument, is that this is solely a hearsay issue. We're looking solely at the admissions of a party opponent and whether it comes in under the hearsay exception or as not hearsay. So that has been my sole focus and brief, and that will be my sole analysis here as well today. As far as the admission of those statements, the state maintains that Martinez's statements were not hearsay and were properly admitted. As set forth in our brief, we submit there was sufficient evidence to establish that the translation in this case was an accurate recitation of Martinez's statements. So as in the Court of Appeals Bedoya decision cited in our brief, we maintain that the transition or translation qualified as Martinez's statements and that they were not hearsay. We disagree with the appellant's assertion.
May I interrupt very briefly?
Sure.
Thank you. I'm getting a little rollback on audio. Am I clear to you, Mr. Liss?
Yeah, you're pretty clear on my end.
Okay, thank you. Assuming that hearsay is, in fact, on the table, would the court need to evaluate in the context of that topic, who is the declarant?
Well, in a lot of the case law that I reviewed, that becomes an issue when you have somebody who really is acting in the capacity of a conduit or whatever we're going to call it. Typically, that's going to come about in the situation, and most of the cases deal with situations where you have, say, a defendant making statements and somebody translating them, and then somebody else, usually an officer, hearing those statements, and then the officer and only the officer is coming in at trial and testifying about what they heard through the interpreter, as far as the statements of the defendant, in which case you then have issues with hearsay and potentially confrontation issues because that person was a conduit and the person who translated was a conduit and they're not present to actually relay that to firsthand, which gives a potential rise to confrontation problem and also an issue then with respect to who is the declarant. But here we would submit that this situation is different and doesn't pose those problems because we have the defendant making firsthand statements that are recorded. And then this individual who translates them, she just listens to those statements firsthand and is just relaying what was said. We have the wrinkle of her translating, of course, but we don't have an issue with her being some sort of intermediary and an officer testifying about what they heard from her. We have her testifying herself. So I don't think to answer your question, I don't think we have a problem with determining who the declarant is. The declarant is the defendant, and she is simply stating what the defendant has said. So I don't think it's really any different than an officer saying, well, this is what the defendant told me in English, and relaying it. It's, we have the wrinkle of the translation, but it's just somebody relaying firsthand what they heard the defendant say, and that's all that happened.
Do I understand that the state is urging that we would adopt some form of the language conduit theory, whether or not that's how it would be announced, but nevertheless, problems with reliability of translation would still remain as an obstacle or indeed a conduit for admission? Would the reliability of the translation still be on the table?
Mr. Liss, before you answer, I think you may have your volume too high.
I've turned it down. Is that better?
I'm sorry, was my question coming through?
Yes, I heard your question, Justice Miller-Lerman. I'm just adjusting my volume to see if that helps with my end.
Well, for a change, the technical problem is not at my end.
It could very well be on mine. Hopefully I'm not too distorted here, or maybe all of my answers typically are anyway, so it won't matter. But to answer your question, I guess the state's position here is that in this particular situation, we don't really need to get into the language conduit issue because we didn't have her acting as a conduit. If that were the situation, then perhaps we would need to get into that framework, and most courts do when you have that situation. But here, since she wasn't actually acting as a conduit, the state's position is that we don't need to get into that. This is just simply a run-of-the-mill situation where the defendant has made statements and she's telling us what the defendant has said. Now, as far as her reliability or the reliability of that translation, could it be an issue? I think that to the extent it would be a matter of weight and credibility of the evidence, not admissibility. The defense is free to argue that translation is not, you know, accurate or accurate enough in any regard and take it with it and argue it's not credible. But from an admissibility standpoint, from a hearsay analysis at least, the dispositive inquiry is, are the statements that were made the statements of the defendant? And in this case, the record reflects that they were, and the district court found that they were, and we don't see any error with the district court's finding or its conclusion in that regard.
What's the defendant's?
So the reliability could be, I beg your pardon, the reliability could still be addressed at the trial level. Is that right? And the reason I was asking is that we've all been directed to the most recent cases, including the one from the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Lopez-Ramos case. And evidently the defendant there spoke ma'am, but the interpreter was obtained through the AT&T language line and spoke Spanish and took the ma'am statements and turned them into Spanish and then into English. So reliability was in the case, so to speak. Does that make sense? So,
yeah. And I think, you know, at some level, reliability could be an issue there because, I mean, a court is going to have to make some determination, at least in this context where you're dealing with translations, that it is, in fact, the defendant's statement, because that's the only way that it comes in.
Right. So, I beg your pardon, Justice Castle, I cut you off, and I beg your pardon.
In this instance, did the jury hear the recording?
I don't recall, Your Honor. I believe the recording came in along with the translation. I know all the translations came in, but yeah, I believe the texts and the phone calls and the interview all came in along with the translation, if I recall correctly.
Thank you.
Mr. Liss, what fact does it have that the translator worked for the police department?
I don't think it has any impact from a admissibility standpoint. And the courts, at least from what I've seen, courts have analyzed that. And typically, again, when they've gone into a more in-depth analysis, they've done it when the person's acting truly as a conduit. When Mitch makes that analysis necessary. But again, the courts that have gone through that, to me, they've said that that's not necessarily dispositive. It doesn't necessarily affect anything, and that's often the situation where somebody who's doing that will be working on behalf of law enforcement. So, you often have officers in the field who are Spanish speaking, and they're obviously working for law enforcement. So I don't see that as posing an obstacle. And again, if the defense wants to challenge the reliability of that based on having some sort of motive or bias, you know, they're certainly free to do so from a credibility standpoint. But I'm not aware of any authority that would say that categorically is going to render that individual biased to the point that their translation is no good and is categorically inadmissible.
Does the harmless error analysis go into this?
Well, in our view, there was no error with the admission of the statements. So we would submit you don't need to get to a harmless error analysis. If you were to do so, I kind of went back and forth on that myself as I looked at this case, because there weren't really any in any of these communications, you know, the interview, the texts, or the phone calls, there were no express confessions or admissions. But at the same time, I would acknowledge, especially with some of the texts, there were some statements that you know, they certainly have undertones of admissions, you know, expressions of remorse and statements to the effect of, you know, if your mom wants to put me in jail, she can do so. I'll head back to Mexico where they can fire the final shot. I mean, there's certainly some statements there that are pretty damning, and you know, they aren't cumulative of anything else. So I guess it comes down to the you know, the standard of review on harmless error. You know, if you strictly apply that surely unattributable language, to me, it's kind of a close call on some of those things. But at the same time, when you take that into consideration with, you know, the usual principles that we also look at the strength of all the other evidence that was properly admitted, you know, I suppose if push came to shove, I would have to argue it was harmless. But I would acknowledge it's certainly not the cleanest case of harmless error if you would get there. And I see I'm out of time here. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 1 minute and 25 seconds.
1 minute and 25 seconds, Ms. Newell.
The state oversimplifies the interpretation issue. These statements were admitted under the language conduit theory at the trial court, and the language conduit theory is untethered to agency law and profoundly misunderstands core principles of interpretation.
What rule are you proposing that we use for this kind of situation?
We are asking the court to help make a rule in term to bridge this gap in between the reliability, to ensure the reliability of statements when a translated statement from a criminal defendant is admitted under the party opponent exception. We are asking that this standard incorporate acknowledged professional standards in the field of language interpretation that account for the highly discretionary nature of interpretation, that look at other sources besides whether or not the interpreter is able to, on objective factors apart from their own opinion of the accuracy of their work, that includes looking at outside sources for translating, review by other individuals, or other factors as listed in federal cases that encompass the highly discretionary nature of interpretation.
Does the interpreter have to qualify as an expert?
That would be something that we would leave up to your discretion. In this case, we didn't think that the Shaversman issue was appropriate because a jury doesn't need an expert to explain what interpretation is necessarily. And under it, the issue presented today is that the translations were admitted by a woman who imposed her own content and meaning on appellant statements, and the trial court admitted the statements as appellant's own personal statements. And so if the court finds that a threshold question to determine if the fact finder, as a gatekeeper, as a fact finder, a threshold question to help ensure that the statements are the defendant's, that's what we would ask. I see that I'm out of time, and we ask that the court reverse the district court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much.